Okay, we're live right now. Hello, Stephen Ignoramus here. Welcome to Call Me Ignorant, episode number 33, 5 o'clock p.m., July 17th, 2019. So pleased you could be with us. Call Me Ignorant is a live conversation show, whether with an interesting content creator, an expert in a field, a controversial figure, or with a fellow human being trying to spread a message. Call Me Ignorant will try to solve the problems of the world, conversationally speaking. We are streaming live right now to YouTube, Twitch, Mixer, DLive, and Picarto. If you can't catch the show live, you can find it after the fact on the above-mentioned platforms, also on BitChute and FreedomScoop.com. Call Me Ignorant is also available in podcast format on Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and Podbean. You can find me on Twitter at IgnoramusSteve. Send me an email at StephenIgnoramus@gmail.com. With me on the program today is Dr. E. Michael Jones. Dr. Jones is a lecturer, an author, and the editor at Culture Wars Magazine. You can find his work online at culturewars.com or at fidelitypress.org. I'm really, really excited to talk to Dr. Jones about his background, some of his written work, and some of the historical events of the last 100 years. Thank you for coming on today, Dr. Jones. How's it going?
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, before we start talking about, some of your written works and stuff like that, when did you first get interested in writing about history and culture and stuff?
Well, actually, funny you should mention that, because I'm doing now a work that I started when I was doing my PhD, which was about 40 years ago. I got my PhD 40 years ago. And then that work went back to material I was doing as an undergraduate. So it's been a long time I've been thinking about this. I'm talking specifically about German idealism. I'm finishing up the chapter on German idealism right now in the Logos book. So it's been, a long period of time where I've been thinking about these ideas, going away from them, coming back to them, that
type of
thing.
Was there a specific, series of events that happened earlier in your life that, inspired you? Was there like a single moment or two that you can point to where you're like, I want to be a writer, I want to get educated on history and things like that?
Well, I was editor of the literary magazine in high school.
Cool.
And I wrote a short story, and I thought at that point I want to be a writer. And then I realized I couldn't do it, so I gave it up. I decided, well, I have to earn a living. I was married. I had a child at that point. So I thought, well, I'll go to graduate school and I'll get a PhD. And that way I can teach. And that way I'll be able to feed my family, since I can't be a writer. Well, I got the job. I got the PhD, got the job, which was unusual at that point. I got fired 1 year after I got to a Catholic college for being against abortion. And at that point, I started being a writer again. So the only job I was ever qualified to do was, I got fired from it, and I abandoned academe at that point, which was the smartest thing I've ever done in my life. And I started a magazine. It was called Fidelity at the time. It was a Catholic magazine. And then it became Culture Wars in the 1990s. And I've been doing that for almost 40 years now. So this is the way God works in your life. You give up something, and if it's God's plan for your life, you're going to get it back.
Wow. So you were fired from St. Mary's College, right?
Right. Notre Dame, right across from Notre Dame.
Was it as simple as you say? You came out against abortion and they just removed you like that? Like, what's the story there?
Well, I'll go back to the MLA convention in the December of 1978. I showed up at the interview with a folding bicycle. I had just ridden it from Philadelphia to New York. No, I took the train. Okay, I didn't ride the whole way. Okay. I rode to the train station. That's why it's a folding bicycle.
Right.
Walked in and I said to them, what's the relationship between feminism and Catholicism at St. Mary's College? And they looked at me and said, where did you get that folding bicycle? So I said, well, I got it in Cambridge, but I'd like to know the relationship between feminism and Catholicism. And they said, well, can you unfold the bicycle? And I said, yeah. And so I unfolded the bicycle, and they never answered the question. So I got there. They gave me the job. And then I got there, and I realized, the relationship is that whenever Catholicism contradicts feminism, feminism trumps Catholicism. And so I got there and I started, it wasn't just abortion. I gave a conference on natural family planning. I called it natural sex. And that was one nail in my coffin. I gave a talk on deconstruction, which was just starting at that time. That was another nail in my coffin. But the week I was being reviewed, I thought I was on a tenure track contract. That's what they told me. And it turns out I got reviewed every year. And the week before I was reviewed by the my peers in the English department, the chairman came to me and she said, many people in the department are upset about your stand on abortion. So I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. But first of all, this is a Catholic college. And secondly, I have academic freedom. Well, I had neither of those things. And as a result, I got fired. And so that's how they did me a favor. The good, the evil that I remember reading in the Bible when Joseph said to his brothers, the evil that you intended to do to me has been turned by God's power into good. And that's exactly what they did because they helped me launch the magazine. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
So, I mean, so I was raised Christian and I still am one. But I wasn't raised Catholic. And I'd always heard since I was a kid that abortion was a no-no in the Catholic Church. But you're saying that they removed you for one of those reasons. And I've heard in other interviews with you that that you've kind of traced back, I don't know if the words corruption or infiltration in the Catholic Church back to like the 60s. Can you, like, what has the path been of the Catholic Church, you know, the last 80 years or so? Like, what's that all about?
The biggest, we're talking about the Catholic Church in the United States of America. Okay. And it was made up of immigrants who wanted to succeed in America. And in order to do that, you have to go along with the dominant ruling class, which at that time was the WASP or the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And this was the fatal flaw of the Catholic Church. They wanted to go along. They wanted to be accepted. So you had people like Bishop John Ireland of St. Paul, Minnesota, who was willing to do anything that the Americans wanted, largely because he was in debt. It's a bad thing to do when you're a bishop, but he was in debt and he needed J.J. Hill to roll over his loans. And so as a result, he became known as an Americanist. And then the Pope condemned Americanism. Pope Leo XIII, God bless him, in 1890, Testem Benevolentiae, said basically that America is no model for the church. The church is the model for America. So that was the conflict in the American church. As Catholics, do we follow America or the Catholic Church? Well, plenty of people wanted to follow America first and the Catholic Church second. All the way up to 1980s, Brian Hare, the assistant to Cardinal Bernardine, comes to St. Mary's College, which fired me at a secret meeting in preparation for a synod, and said, the church needs to learn from America when it comes to sexual issues. That was the latest form of Americanism. You could see it in a guy like Cardinal McCarrick, the homosexual, who basically wanted the permission slip that American culture was giving homosexuals at the time and was willing to compromise his Catholic faith to get it. That's the whole story in a nutshell.
Wow. So do you see different sects of different religions as kind of nations in themselves, like separate from the nation, a part of the nation, or like is the Catholic Church its own nation to you?
No.
Okay.
The nation, we're talking about ethnos, the Irish people, for example, the German people, the Italian people, blah, blah, blah. They are nations. Nation is based on language. The Catholic Church is the guide to all nations. It is transnational. And when it ruled Europe under Christendom, Europe was an incredibly dynamic place and would have become even more dynamic were it not for the Reformation, which basically destroyed the unity of Christendom because the aristocrats got greedy and they wanted to steal church property. So the Reformation was a looting operation. There was no theological justification for the Reformation whatsoever in England. In Germany, there was some justification provided by our friend Martin Luther, but it could not have happened by itself without the greed of the aristocrats who wanted to steal church property. So we have suffered ever since. The world has suffered ever since as a result of this split.
Wow. So, you know, one of the things that I've seen you in a few interviews now, and I definitely want to read some of your books. But how do you do research? I mean, it seems like you have so much information and names and stuff like that in your head. Like, was this did you get good at research and memory, or did you how do you prepare for a book and how do you research?
I sit down, I get an idea, I sit down and think, start reading books. I take notes on the computer. And gradually the idea starts to form in my mind and I begin to see the scope of the book. Now, I didn't start off in life writing a 1,400-page book like Baron Metal or his book like The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. I started off writing articles in a magazine. It was the best thing I could do because I had a deadline every month. I had to get the magazine every month. And it got me into the habit of doing meeting deadlines every month and doing research and writing on a regular basis. And that's the secret. In terms of memory, the main aid to memory is organization. You know, if you put your, if the hammer is under the pillow in your bed, you're probably not going to find it when you need it because you need to put it in a tool chest. And that way you can remember where it is because you know where it is. And the intellectual life is just a more sophisticated version of that. You have an organization, and that's what allows you to remember things. The ultimate organization of the universe is called Logos, and that's the book I'm writing now. And we have that. We understand things because the world is an orderly place, and it's an orderly place because it was created by God, and it mirrors the ultimate order of the universe, which is the mind of God.
Mm. So these words you're saying, they're Greek words, right? Logos, ethnos.
Logos.
Okay, and it means many different things, right? It means like word and truth. Can you explain what logos is? It's not just one thing, correct?
It is the basis of Greek philosophy,
okay.
which at a certain point started off but with people who were physicists. And they thought that there was a material basis for the universe. So Thales thought it was water, and Anaxagoras thought it was air, and Heraclitus thought it was fire. And then at a certain point, someone said, no, it's order. It's logos. It's the mind, nous, the mind. There is a mind behind this, and that is the source. And at that point, mankind took a huge leap from the material into the spiritual or the intellectual. And then it developed along those lines. Eventually, the physikoi, the physicists, they lacked instruments that would allow them to measure the universe. And so philosophy shifted away to the lawyers. The lawyers took over philosophy, and they were known as sophists. And Socrates, and actually lawyers are still known as sophists,
yeah.
Funnily enough. And Socrates took it in a new direction, and Plato and Aristotle and so on and so forth. But the real change came with when St. John wrote the gospel in Greek, his gospel, and he used the word logos. He said, in the beginning there was logos, and logos was with God, and logos was God. And that changed the course of human history. Because now you had insight into God that the human mind could never find on its own. God had to reveal that. And because he revealed that, we could function on a much higher level. So the point of all of history after that is either you understand the Trinity, which is what I just described, or you get left behind by the course of history. And so one instance of a man who tried, who was on the right track, was Hegel. His dialectic is based on the Trinity, but for reasons I go into in the book, he screwed up, and Logos once again got defeated. But every defeat, it continues in another direction, another vein.
Wow. So, and that's the book you're writing right now is called Logos.
It's called Logos Rising, the history of Logos and the Logos of history.
Wow. Is there a book that, do most of your books stand alone on their own? Like, is there a book that, if someone's trying to get into your work that someone should read first of yours?
Well, you just go according to your interests. I've written on just about every topic under the sun so far.
Right.
So what are you interested in? If you're interested in economics, begin with Baron Metal. If you're interested in the history of the Jews, the Jewish revolutionary spirit. If you're interested in sex, which most people are, libido dominandi, sexual liberation and political control. And so on. If you're interested in horror movies, try Monsters from the Id. Interested in music, try Dionysus Rising. interested in architecture, try Living Machines. I got all of these books. You can find them all on the website. So begin with what you're interested in. The secret to the intellectual life is following your interests. You know, you can be, your kids are just bored in school because they have information poured over them on a daily basis. And as soon as they get interested in something, they do research and they come up with the most amazing stuff. This is the secret to a successful intellectual life. You have to follow your interests and develop the skills that allow you to come up with some type of resolution answer to the questions you want to ask.
Wow. So, yeah, so I think the one that I'm the most interested in is Slaughter of Cities. And could you just tell for the people what the premise of that book is and kind of just a little bit, a brief history of, I think it's like urban renewal through ethnic cleansing, I believe.
Yeah, that's the subtitle. Urban renewal is ethnic cleansing. Okay. It's about the destruction of our cities. This was the story of my life in many ways because I grew up a victim of ethnic cleansing. You weren't even allowed to call it that. They had to call it white flight, which is a misnomer. It was ethnic cleansing. First of all, because the people, the Irish, are not white until they get to the suburbs, at least. And secondly, it wasn't a willing thing on their part. They were forced into it by demographic pressures of the sort that we're seeing in Europe now. The same type of use of demographic of immigration that is now being used to destroy the cultures of Western Europe was used in the cities of Philadelphia, cities of America like Philadelphia, for example, because the WASP ruling class wanted to destroy Catholic political power. And the simplest way to do that was to destroy the neighborhoods where Catholics live. That was the story of my life. And that's in Slaughter of Cities.
Do you know when the term white first started getting used? Is it, you know, in the 20th
yes.
century? Yeah, tell me.
Yes. First time you saw a black man, you became white. Before you saw the black man, you were an Englishman. You don't become white until you see, until you're confronted with someone who is not white. It's a completely negative term. So you can ask me another question. When did I become a Mzungu? Do you know what a Mzungu is?
No.
Are you a Mzungu?
What is that?
Mzungu is the Swahili word for white guy.
Oh.
So you become a Mzungu when you show up in Kenya or Tanzania or Uganda. And so if I yell out in the street in South Bend, "Hey Mzungu," nobody turns around. But if somebody yells and I'm walking down the streets of Dar es Salaam, which I was about 3 years ago, and I didn't, the only white face I ever saw was when I looked in the mirror. If somebody yelled Mzungu, I would turn around. But I didn't know that until I got there. This was the plight of the immigrants from Europe, the Catholic immigrants especially. They showed up here thinking they were Irish. They lived in an Irish neighborhood where everybody was Irish and Catholic, and they didn't know they were white until the black people showed up. And that was the beginning of the ethnic cleansing that drove them into the suburbs where they became white.
Have you done much research into now Protestants founded America, right? There weren't too many Catholics here at the time, correct?
No, that's not true.
Okay.
Not true.
Yeah, tell me about that.
But,
yeah.
So Christopher Columbus was not a Protestant. Cortez was not a Protestant. The Jesuits who colonized Canada, they were French Catholics. So the Protestants, the English Protestants, were in relative latecomers to the North American continent. And they were victorious in a series of wars. And that's why I speak English. And that's why America is the country that it is.
Interesting. And so do you get into any of that in Slaughter of Cities? I guess it's not about the founding of America and stuff like that.
No, that's way past the time that we're talking about. Right. If you want to know about that period of time, I have a whole chapter on the Jesuit relations in Paraguay in the 16th century in Barren Metal, and also a description of what happened in Canada with the French Canadians. That's also in that book, if you're interested in that story. And I also spent a week in Guadalajara with David Duke, trying to convert him to Catholicism, and I failed, but I ended up writing an ebook called Ethnos Needs Logos. And that goes into that whole story of, first of all, the relationship between the ethnic group group and religion or ethnic group and other kinds of identity. But also it goes into the details of why Guarani, for example, is the official language of Paraguay. And who was responsible
wow.
for that?
Wow. So, you know, one thing that I mean, I hear you talking about usury a lot, and I, you know, I've read about that in the Bible and stuff like that. But when does, you know, from what I understand, usury is, you know, loaning at an unfair or immoral interest rate. When does something become usury, and when does it become just a loan?
If you want the authentic Catholic Church teaching on usury, go to the Vatican website and type in Vix Pervenit, and you will get the encyclical of Pope Benedict the 14th, 1745, in which he says any interest on a loan is usurious. Loans are immoral because there is no shared risk in a loan. If you have money and you want to invest it and someone needs your money to build his business, you should share the risk by buying stock in the company. Mm. If you lend the company money, there is no shared risk and you're taking unfair advantage of whoever you lend the money to. This is the fundamental rule that is the basis of the Catholic Church teaching and why usury is immoral. It later became exorbitant interest rates, but that was completely abolished when the Fed, under Paul Volcker, got into destroying the workforce in the United States by raising interest rates into the stratosphere. The government, you could get a T-bill that paid 20% in the 1970s, which basically wrecked it was the beginning of the destruction of the manufacturing base of America. Because no one is going to risk his money if he can get guaranteed 20% from the government. This is another reason why usury is bad.
Interesting. So, you know, another question I have is, you know, like I said, I'm not really a Catholic, but what is the relationship between the church and the Pope? I mean, I've heard before that he is, basically make something a sin or not a sin, and that he's like infallible somewhat in the eyes of God. Explain what the Pope is, other than just a leader and, you know, what everyone knows about the Pope already.
The Pope is the vicar of Christ on earth. He's okay. The vicar means representative. Okay. Jesus Christ chose Peter to be the first Pope, even though Peter was a sinner and betrayed him. And he said to Peter, "You are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church." And if you go to Rome, St. Peter's Basilica in Rome, you can go to the bottom of the dome, and there in gold letters, about 7 feet high, is that statement in Latin, "Tuus Petrus et super hunc patrum edificabo ecclesiam meam." The church was created by Jesus Christ with Peter as its first leader, because any organization, in order to have unity, has to have some guy who is responsible for the whole operation. Over this period of time, any group that breaks with the church will create disunity and will lose its vitality, because Peter, as the bishop of what is the bishop of Rome, and the bishop and the Rome has always had a priority or a primacy among all of the other churches, because ultimately in any organization you're going to have some man or some institution who decides what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is bad. You can't have an institution without someone taking that responsibility. If you don't have that one person, you'll have chaos. And that's what we see was the result of the Protestant Reformation. There are now 30-some thousand Protestant sects in the United States, and all of them, they contradict each other. There's no unity, and the more they break off, the more insignificant they become. The church because it had this unity, it was considered a formidable opponent to the American empire, to the American regime. And that's why America set out to destroy the Catholic Church in the period following World War II.
Wow. So, you know, we're running out a little low on time right here. So, one of the things I wanted to ask you about that I've heard you talk about is Pete Buttigieg. That you knew him before he got involved in politics or whatever, that you close to him?
We were close. I never heard of the guy until he ran for mayor. Now, many people had never heard of the guy, but I happen to live two houses down the street from him, and I have children all around his age. And we never heard of the guy. He just stayed at home. He was the classic kitchen window child who sat at home with his father's professor friends and listened to them talk about politics, left-wing politics. His father was a professor at Notre Dame, promoted, was the editor of Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci's notebooks, the left with the Italian communist. And he was the man who basically mainstreamed people like Gramsci and Foucault, Michel Foucault, the homosexual Frenchman, at Notre Dame. And now we see the implementation of those theories in Mayor Pete, our gay mayor, our homosexual mayor, who has been a loyal servant of the oligarchs for his entire life. He's gotten a Rhodes Scholarship.
You froze. You were just talking about, the last thing you said was like an instrument of the oligarchs about Pete Buttigieg. So you can keep going if you want.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much all you need to know.
Yeah.
What you're seeing now is the latest revolutionary spirit is the manifestation of it is the homosexual movement. The homosexuals now are the proxy warriors of the oligarchs. When I was 6 years old living in that Irish neighborhood, the black people of South Carolina and North Carolina, they were the proxy warriors of the oligarchs. They were being brought into our neighborhood by the Ford Foundation using Protestant ministers in that city to basically ethnically cleanse the parish, the Catholic population of Philadelphia, drive them into the suburbs where they became white. The homosexual is now the proxy warrior of the oligarchs. And this, the proof of this is the fact that the mass mainstream media take Pete Buttigieg seriously. Mm. There are many other mayors in Indiana who have done a better job than he has in running their cities. No one would take any of these people seriously. No one would take Pete Buttigieg seriously unless he announced he was a homosexual. That is code word for the oligarchs as to say to them, I'll do anything you want. I'm your loyal servant. Just send me money and I'll do your bidding. That is why I say that. That is why you go to Harvard. I say this because my son went to Harvard. That is what the Rhodes Scholarship exists for. It is to create administrators for the British Empire and now the American Empire. So that's why I say this about Pete Buttigieg.
Why? So, you know, as far as the proxy, you know, groups as proxy warriors and stuff like that, you know, that's one of the most people I talk to that are liberals or of the left or whatever. They care about these groups. They think groups are oppressed and stuff like that. What advice would you give to a person trying to convince them of your message if they're not willing to read like a 1,000-page book? I mean, in my opinion, if someone's not willing to seek out information, it's going to be very hard for them to be convinced anyway. But what can someone do to try to convince them of that that's an agenda-driven thing rather than, fairness and that narrative.
I can't convince anyone against their will.
Yeah.
So that's impossible. You can't do that. If what I'm saying sounds plausible to you, and yet you doubt it, then I recommend that you read the book because the book has all the footnotes. The book is the first fruit of all of this research. It was hammered out, you know, in white heat during these, periods 20, 25 years ago. That's where you're either, my theories are going to stand or fall, not in YouTube conversations. I'm grateful for YouTube because it allows me to talk about this, but the CEO summary, the elevator speech, is not the same thing as the book. And I stand by the book. My brain shuts down when I'm talking. Sometimes I've taken a medication that may be groggy. You never know when you're going to be speaking, but the book stands. So read the book. There's no shortcut. Okay, read the book. Go to culturewars.com, read the book, and then prove me a liar by stating something in the book. That's the way it's going to stand or fall.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I just have like one more question. It's I remember I've been listening to you speak for about, I think, 6 or 7 months or something like that. And I remember the day that your Wikipedia just got straight up deleted. And, you know, and so you were caught up in like the adpocalypse. You had some of your videos taken down, demonetized and stuff like that. Why do you think you're seen as like a controversial figure or maybe even a dangerous figure to people in power?
Well, I had a guy in the military who once told me the only time you get flak is when you're over the target.
Mm.
So I'm over the target. I'm talking about things that people are afraid to talk about. I'm talking about topics that will, if you were to say them as a university professor, you would get fired immediately. That's why I got fired as a university professor. That was God's plan for my life, to remove me from that situation so I could tell the truth. And that's it. I mean, all of this rigmarole about hate speech, which is now going on in, you know, places like YouTube and stuff like that, is censorship. There's no other word for it. I just did an e-book, which you can get on Amazon Kindle, called Jewish Privilege, in which I show how hate speech was created by the Anti-Defamation League to basically suppress any type of discussion of Jewish malfeasance in the culture. Okay, I go into detail about the background of the ADL and their connection to organized crime figures like Meyer Lansky and Mo Dalitz. I go into the money laundering that the ADL was involved with figures like Mo Dalitz, who was a casino guy, you know, gave them lots of money, and then they give him an award, and suddenly you can't criticize him as a criminal because they call you an anti-Semite. This is the background to hate speech. You cannot understand this debate unless you understand the background of the ADL, and that's why I wrote this book.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. I'll let you go. And what I'm going to do after this is I'm going to buy a copy of Slaughter of Cities and I'm going to give it a read. And I'll be following your work closely. And thank you so much for your time, Dr. Jones.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
All right. Take care. Hey, I want to thank everybody who checked out Call Me Ignorant today and also the ones who checked us out after today. You can find this uploaded to YouTube, BitChute, and FreedomScoop.com as a video, and Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and Podbean as a podcast. You can follow me on Twitter at IgnoramusSteve or send me an email at StephenIgnoramus@gmail.com. If you feel like you've benefited from the show and want to support, you can donate via DLive, PayPal, or Streamlabs, or sign up with a monthly pledge on Bitbacker, Subscribestar, or Patreon. All of that is linked below in the show description. I hope everyone out there enjoyed the show. My guest today was Dr. E. Michael Jones, editor and founder of Culture Wars Magazine, author of books such as Slaughter of Cities, Barren Metal, and The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit. Have a fantastic day, everybody out there. Go inform yourselves.